Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's show, we return to the world of witchcraft in the company of witch and abaya practitioner, Emma Catherine. Emma's new book, Witch Life, is a wonderful tome to pick up if you're nervous about taking your first steps into the world of modern witchcraft. By utilising her mixed heritage, Emma has brought a refreshingly honest, humble, and supportive guide into the world, allowing the reader to take their own paths into the world of magic. We discuss how Emma has blended abaya and wicca, creating altars, the sabbats, cycles of the moon, and much more in a thoroughly enjoyable conversation. Emma has a wonderful way of explaining witchcraft in an easy to understand way, and it was a delight to speak with her. Don't forget, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon at $4 a month. That gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. You can sign up either by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or click on the link in the show notes as always. Mysteries and Monsters is on all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and merchandise. As always, a big thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show, as always, is produced by Brennan Stahl from the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. My appearance on Craig Bryant's Paranormal Pendle podcast is now available, so if you click on the link on the show notes if you'd like to hear me talking about some of Sheffield's most famous hauntings. Now, Emma joins me to show us just how we can make everyday magical. On this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Emma Catherine to discover how we can make everyday magical. In her new book, Witch Life, Emma offers an insightful and practical guide on how we can develop our interests and knowledge in using witchcraft and bringing it into our day-to-day lives. Emma, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Oh, I'm delighted to be on. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. It's nice to kind of delve into these subjects as someone that's always been aware of witchcraft. I have to say, even with my rudimentary knowledge of the subject, I am amazed at the growth over the last sort of 10 or 20 years in the subject, Emma, across the world, it would seem, especially in the West. Obviously, you're based not too far away from me, just down the road in the next county along. So how did you find yourself developing an interest in this field?
Do you know what? I think it happened quite naturally because growing up, you know, and I talk to a lot of Americans and I have a lot of American friends and especially people from what they call the Bible Belt. And it's really weird when I talk about being raised in quiet, and there weren't any spiritual beliefs in my house, but there weren't any strict atheism or anything like that. So I always describe my mum as being a bit of a hippie anyway.
Yeah.
Although my paternal grandmother, when she came over from Jamaica, she was quite religious, as in you'd go around and, you know, there'd be pictures of Christ on the mount on the wall and and so forth. But it wasn't really impressed upon her children and subsequently the grandchildren. So there was always that room to explore growing up. And I loved like reading when I was a kid. It was my world, a door into like the wider world. Grew up working class on a council estate, so opportunities were quite limited. So reading was a way of reaching out into the world, I guess. And I always loved stories with a hint of magic. And I know like now some of her stuff is, you might wince a little bit, but Enid Blyton was one of my favourite authors. Like The Wishing Tree and like the Tamer stuff. It's only when you grow up and you kind of become more aware. At the time, the Peter Rabbit novels and all of the rest of them, they kind of opened the door into magical worlds. And the more you read, so then as I grew up, I was always an avid reader. So by the time I was 14, I was reading my mum's Stephen King's and lots of those deal with themes that, you know, you might just imagine he's a horror writer, but, you know, there's lots of different things.
Yes.
And all of those just open pathways where you might start looking into stuff a little bit more, or you might read something so you research it a little bit. And so I guess I can't pinpoint any one thing, but there were lots of little ways in, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think for many of us who grew up in very similar circumstances, Emma, because obviously I'm of working class stuff, you know, reading was a necessity.
Into
a different world for all of us, you know what I mean? And I think, like you saying, we can look at some of these authors we grew up with, and obviously now in a more modern context, obviously some of the subject matter and the characterization does, as you say, you know, makes you go a little bit. But I think often you have to sort of also view it in the way of the world and the way it was written at the time, rather than looking at it with our modern views and our balance, tolerance, really. And I think if it gives you that appetite for and a thirst for knowledge and to read more, then as with anything, reading is incredibly addictive, and it's something I love doing. One of the joys of this show is I've really reconnected. I've probably read more books in the last 3 years than I have in the previous 30, but it's such an easy thing to do, and it's relaxing, it's informative, and it's just something that can kind of, as you say, once you sort of start connecting the dots, it can lead you down all kinds of avenues.
Yes. I always remember when I was studying for my English degree, and I think one of the things about studying that you might not realise, especially for a lot of, again, working class youths who go into university might not ever cross their mind. And one of the things about studying in the arts, although it's kind of looked down upon as not being practical, I guess, is that it opens you up to a wide world. So I can always remember reading Wide Song SOC.
Yes.
By GM East. And you're reading it, and it was the first time I'd read a novel or a book or any kind of literature where Obeah was specifically mentioned. And not only that, but in a positive light. So Christophine, the Obeah woman in the novel, is an extremely important character. And so, again, that kind of link between fiction and reality and history and how it all intertwines. So it's really fascinating.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those things as well, because when you deal with subjects and the culture of Obeah, a lot of people, it tends to get overshadowed by voodoo and voodoo in regards to being overlooked, really, even though it's probably as important in certain areas of the Caribbean and West Africa. It's a deeply important cultural belief. And it's one of those things that I think, when, unless you know that much about it, people tend to kind of just group them all together, as they tend to do with sort of pagan beliefs as well, where everybody, you know, and I've said this with some of my other guests, Emma, that people tend to throw all the Celts into a pot that everybody's the same. And that's the same, I think, when it comes to when you're dealing with the belief systems from the Caribbean, because a lot of people don't see these little nuances and differences in between these belief systems.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And even from people perhaps who are of Caribbean heritage, but perhaps don't live in the Caribbean. I can remember that a couple of years ago, I was listening to a talk, and it was from the author of a book called Obeah, Race and Racism. And the author's name is Eugenie O'Neill. And it's a very well-written, well-researched historical text that looks at the links between Obeah and racism and from the slave trade and throughout. And at the end, she had a Q&A. And so she was kind of saying in a passing comment how voodoo is quite well known, voodoo is quite well known, generally speaking, most people have heard of it, even if they may not understand what it is, whereas Obeah is less well known. And, you know, there were lots of comments about, well, what's the difference? I always thought they were the same thing. So you're right, you know, there is that tendency to lump everything that looks similar together. And again, with kind of British folklore and history, you know, we talk about, you know, we just had Beltane and Maydane. We talk about Beltane and we talk about how it was practiced in the British Isles by da 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 da. And it sounds like everyone in the British Isles practiced this one celebration in this particular way, but that's not true, you know. There's lots of nuance between different places, even within the same county. And, you know, so I find all of that so interesting. I am a proper nerd.
I am as well, because it's one of those things that, to my shame, Emma, I kind of ignored British folklore for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's something I've really developed a real interest in over the last sort of 5 or 10 years, because I found it very interesting that along with the rise of Wicca, and the opening up of witchcraft in a more positive and progressive light, then a lot of these old folk traditions seem to be having a bit of a rebirth as well. And it's almost as if, because of the world we are in and how far along we've come in the last 30 or 40 years, it seems that people are desperately trying to find something that they feel comfortable with rather than just fitting into the normal expectations that a lot of us were brought up within the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that's a lot to do with the rise of witchcraft today, and it's continued. Yeah, I think Wicca's like, or I don't know if it's still the case, but at one point it was like the fastest growing religion in the States.
Mm.
And I think you're right, it's about that yearning and that longing. And I think it's interesting because I try and not read comments on stuff online, not even when it's not my own stuff. If it's something that's controversial,
yeah,
like an article or an essay, and I read it, I try and not read the comments because it's like going into the abyss. Just no, I haven't got time for that drama, because oftentimes there's lots of negativity at both extreme ends.
Mm.
So I just think, but I think a lot of that is because people do feel disconnected from whatever. It might be their heritage. It might be something they're interested in. It might just be that they're looking for something and they don't know what it is they're looking for, but they're searching for something.
Mm.
And it can be quite difficult. You know, I think our modern age is brilliant and we're quite open-minded and there's lots of technology and we all walk around with computers, powerful computers in our pocket, all information at our fingertips. So there's definitely a searching for something, but I think sometimes we just don't know where to start.
Yeah. And I think often, and this is one of the great positives of your latest book, is the fact that I think whenever someone develops an interest in something that's become so well established, that it can be extremely daunting for somebody that's wanting to dip their toe into it and sort of start off. Because as with any source of information or belief system, it's all about where you go. And often when we're talking about things like this is one of the great positives of social media and the internet, is it's allowed people from all over the world who may be in small towns and villages, wherever they are, to connect with people, whereas in their immediate vicinity, Emma, they may not have access to either that information or that social system where they've got people they can talk about these things. And I think when you talk about the growth of Wicca and the sort of understanding of the nuances of a beer in regards to voodoo, then it's allowed people to really sort of develop a knowledge that 30 years ago they wouldn't have the first idea of where to start.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's important that everybody kind of shares their experiences, because I think you're right, social media has been so beneficial to us in terms of the information that's available to us. When I was first interested as a teenager, you know, I'd go to my little local library in my little market town and there might be one or two books and, you know, and they're very limited on what they're about. But nowadays, online shopping, just the wealth of free information that's online is great. But it also comes with a downside as well. And part of what can make people feel so daunting is that there's almost like a celebrity side to witchcraft and Wicca. And I think one of the pitfalls can be where, I guess because of that, in a way, there's also lots of scam artists.
Mm.
And I think one of the real difficulties, or something that I particularly struggled with, I think, was kind of sorting what was fact and what was opinion.
Yes.
Because a lot of stuff that's written is presented as fact. And that's not to say that it's wrong. We can talk about our experiences, but I think it's important to note that they are our own personal subjective experiences, and it's not going to be the same for the next person. And so, you know, you kind of have to be careful when you navigate all of that information. So I often say to people, one of the best things you can do is question the people who are putting themselves across as teachers, you know, because if they are genuine, then they will look forward to those questions. They will not shy away from debate and discussion. And I think it's important that our communities become places where we can have debates and discussions that don't kind of descend into kind of name calling and side making and whatnot.
Absolutely. And I think often it can be, as you refer to there, Emma, it's very difficult, because when it comes to something like Wicca and the belief systems, it's not a one size fits all. It's not all or nothing. There are so many different tenets to it and facets to it that it's all about how much you want to get out of it, I think, in my personal opinion, because I think a lot of people kind of think that once you go into it, that's it. You have to go in all guns blazing and do everything and be doing sort of daily manifestations and sort of building your own charms and meditating at your own altar every day. Whereas I think for a lot of people, that's just too much. And I know this is one of the great aspects of your book, because it's essentially a very practical beginner's guide for people without sort of dumbing it down. You're sort of saying to people, well, this is my ideas of where you should start. However, I'm not telling you what's right and wrong. I'm just saying, these are some of the things you can do and where they may take you.
Yeah. What I hope comes across in the book is that these are all things that I have done in my own personal practice that I've found useful. And I just think that sometimes it is too much, you know, all of those things you just mentioned, like meditation at altar and ritual. I love all of those things. But at the same time, I have a full-time job and a family and all of that stuff. And it's not realistic. And I think a lot of the time, particularly for beginners who are starting out, it's easy to think, oh, it's the full moon coming up, I'm going to do something for it. And then the full moon passes and then you realize you've missed it. And it's like, oh no, well, maybe next time. And then before you know it, you end up not doing anything.
Mm.
And I think that's when you can kind of fall into a rut, or you can maybe become disenfranchised with it. And so the idea of the book was really that you could go to it at any time. You know, some days I want to do a full-on ritual. Some days I just want to do it just for the sake of, well, not just for the sake of it. It's always for a purpose. But the intent and the outcome, it doesn't always have to be the full-on ritual. You can always do something else that is just as meaningful. But sometimes I like the ritual. But also sometimes I just want to do a quick something. And so the idea of the book was that you could go to it at any time when you perhaps want to do something, or perhaps just looking for inspiration. Maybe you're stuck in a bit of a rut, because it's easy to get in a rut.
Mm.
And there's something for anything, any time of the year, any kind of mood phase, all of that kind of stuff. So that was really the inspiration.
Absolutely. And it's nice that I found the book very refreshingly honest and humble, because it's not very often you'll see someone say, well, when I started doing this, I had no idea what I was doing and where I was going to go. And obviously, because of your heritage, Emma, I suppose it was quite difficult to focus on particular aspects of a beer and Wicca as well, because you'd got that kind of friction in case you were focusing too much on one particular side. So I'm very interested to find out how you found a balance in using your heritage in regards to how you practice witchcraft and the way you work it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was mostly a case of trial and error, because for a long time, particularly like say growing up in a rural town in the middle of England with perhaps not so many resources as we have today, all you really have access to is a small slice of what's out there. And of course you don't know anything else. And so for a long time, you kind of feel like that's all there was. And I certainly felt that way about Wicca. I felt that was all there was. There was just Wicca. And so you go with it. And by the way, nothing against Wicca at all. There's nothing wrong with it at all. But when you don't realize there's all the stuff out there and some aspects of it you feel don't quite fit, but you try and make them fit anyway because you feel like, this is the thing and I need to do the thing. So this is what I'll do. And so you kind of do all of that. And for a long time, you kind of doubt yourself, you know, particularly when you're new, because you're new and inexperienced. So you kind of doubt yourself and you kind of tell yourself that maybe this is just getting used to it, you knew, but that feeling doesn't go away. And I think many people feel like that because we are, humans are like complex beings. We're not a one size fits all. And even like within ourselves, there's so many strands and threads and, you know, regardless of our heritage, that, like I say, we're complex beings. And so it's not always so easy as just one size fits all. So when I kind of discovered other things, so not just Obeah, but even Verdun and traditional British witchcraft, or more akin to folk magic, you kind of, not that I rebelled against Wicca, but you kind of explore things differently, and it's all new and there's lots to look at. And after a while, I kind of found that I was always focusing on one thing and I felt that the other side was kind of missing out. So with the traditional witchcraft, you know, when I kind of, I love that side of it and I practice it for a long time, but then you kind of think, well, I'm forgetting this side of myself. So you go the other way and it's almost like a pendulum swinging there, back and forth. And I thought, I just decided that, you know what? It doesn't have to be this way. And again, this is, I guess, something that happens online a lot. There can be a lot of gatekeeping. And so, you know, you'll have someone say, well, you can't do this because of this, or you can't do that because of that. And so for a long time, you listen to that because you think, well, they're saying it, so it must be so. And it's not always the case. I mean, don't get me wrong, sometimes it is. So for example, if you take Voodoo, which I tend to kind of describe more as a religion in that it has its own set beliefs, it has its own set deities and the lower, you know, there are certain things that you do in a certain way on certain days for specific lower. And each temple or each house has like slight variation. So what one house does for one particular lower will be different to what another house or temple does for that same lower. But generally, there are those rules to follow from your house or temple. Whereas Obeah is really quite different. I guess I describe it as Jamaican witchcraft in that, and I guess I see it more as a spirit tradition and through which, you know, magic is worked as well. And so, I don't know, it was kind of, I felt that I wanted to take parts that worked for me and make it my own. And I think that's why, I don't know, it seems to be going well so far. Such what?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the key thing, isn't it? It's finding what works for the individual, as you say, rather than trying to do it. And even if you don't feel comfortable with it or you feel lost, that you keep trying to force yourself into practices or a routine that simply doesn't satisfy you. And I think, as you were referring to earlier, that will simply just disenfranchise you and make you lose interest with it and just say, oh, I can't be bothered with it. Whereas I think when you begin to understand it, and maybe that's something that all of us go through, that as we mature as individuals, we begin to understand in all aspects of our lives and what works for us and what we're comfortable with. And that's not to say that we should sort of shy away from challenges, but I think often too many people try to fit in or just go with the flow. And I think eventually you get to a point in life where you can either carry on doing that or just take a step back and say, no, I'm going to focus on what I like and what works for me and how what gives me pleasure and enjoyment and follow that path instead.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I often describe, and it's corny and a cliche, I know, but, you know, like describing it as a spiral instead of a circle, it makes sense because, you know, sometimes you revisit things that you kind of thought were beginner or that you kind of touched upon at the beginning of your practice. And when you revisit them through, and you know, you've got all of that experience and knowledge that you've gathered along your journey that you didn't have the first time around, it can put a new perspective on things that you thought were basic. Or I feel like having a practice, a practical practice, and kind of taking the time to explore what that means to you. And as long as, if you're doing something, that's a practice. Because I think sometimes there can be a tendency to get offended when we talk about having a practice and the importance of a practical practice. And the thing is, it doesn't matter what that looks like. There's no judgment. If you're doing something, you know, on a regular basis, you've got a practice right there, right? And so I think as we explore and we experience, I think that's the most important part, the experience, and then taking the time to reflect on those experiences and assimilating them. So like in my day job, I work in a SEND school. I teach children with autism.
Yes.
And a lot of the work we do kind of, for me, reflects on what we talk about in magic. You know, we talk about giving people strategies to kind of make their situations better for them.
Yeah.
And I see the parallels to what we do in witchcraft and your own personal practices. The experiences we have allow us to create strategies to build our craft up into what we want it to be. And so I think there are no right and wrong ways of doing that. I used to, back in my younger days, I used to fight kickboxing and boxing down at the local gym. And again, there's lots of parallels between magic and fighting. And it's those same things we're talking about. You do those same things over and over again and it becomes a practice. And over time, and you don't kind of see it happening until you look back. But all of those hours of practice are developing you. And it's... you don't always recognize it when that's happening. And sometimes it can be challenging and sometimes it can be hard and sometimes you have to make sacrifices. So, for example, if you're tired at the end of the day and you can't be bothered to, I don't know, do a full-blown ritual, but what can you do then? Can you, I don't know, sit and light a candle and perhaps just take 5 minutes just to, not even just to do anything. I think the act of doing nothing is extremely important and we don't place enough value on it, I guess. That in itself, if you did that every day, that becomes a practice of sitting, you know. So I think experience and taking the time to experience things and to say, you know what, I did this and it doesn't work for me, or maybe I'm going to change it this way. Maybe I can make it work for me, you know. And all of those things are okay to do.
And I think with anything, as you say, with your background in teaching and the hobbies that you refer to there in regards to fighting and things, if anything, it teaches you how to be adaptable. And I know we've said it before, that it's not a one-size-fits-all. And obviously, when you're working in the educational sector that you are, Emma, you have to be super flexible and adaptable, because each pupil is going to have different requirements and different sort of triggers that you have to work around. And that often can be reflected in, you know, when you're training at kickboxing and boxing, not every opponent's going to be the same. You've got to take every challenge in a different way, because if you simply keep doing the same things, more often than not, you'll just end up flat on your backside.
Yeah. And I think as well, like, it's important to say how much in teaching and in training, whatever sport you're doing, or the changes that happen, that you make happen, the most important changes occur within yourself. And kind of when you flick that switch, and it's the same with witchcraft, when that kind of switch flicks in your mind, it's like a light bulb moment. So in teaching, it might be, I think one of the things that a lot of teachers and people new to the profession struggle with is kind of, especially with autistic children, because they are great and their wit is like, you know. And so, you know, you see a lot of inexperienced staff kind of being drawn into arguments. And I always say to them, just like, you know, sometimes you have to let stuff go over your head, because once you get into an argument with them, you've lost and they've won, and, you know. And it's the same in when you're in the middle of a fight. You know, people often talk about, oh, well, you know, why don't you think of someone saying something mean to you? And it's, well, no, it's not that kind of fight. You know, you have to stay measured. You have to stay calm. There's a lot of control. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the changes that are important occur within ourselves. And it's the same with witchcraft as well. Like I say, once you kind of get your head around, actually, I'm going to experiment with this. I'm going to see what works for me. I'm going to take my time. I don't have to answer to anybody else. You know, I think once you kind of get that mindset, things become slightly easier in that. And I think that's just part of naturally growing older as well. I often say to people that the best part of getting older is you just care less what people think.
Very true. Very true. I suppose one of the biggest challenges then, Emma, is when you came to sort of pull the book together on how you were going to sort of focus it, because obviously you've broken it down into certain sections and it's all about sort of giving people a breakdown of certain subjects, such as covering things like hexing and the moon cycles and the sabbats, which is something that often people know a bit about, but probably not as much as they think they do. But also it's all about, when I read the book, it's as we've said earlier on, it's about these are the things you can do. You don't have to do all of them. You just, if you want to start doing a little thing, you can. And I think, as we say often, people will try to do too much too soon, whereas your book basically says to people, calm down, you don't have to go at 100 miles an hour, take little bite sizes and work from there. So when you were sort of pulling it together, did you kind of think how the book would flow in regards to what you wanted people to sort of go through in regards to the chapters that you'd set out?
In a way, I guess the book was quite interesting to write because I started writing it in the first lockdown back in, was it 2019 or 2020? It seems so long ago. But you know, when we first went into that very first lockdown, and
yes,
everyone followed the rules and like the streets became like an apocalypse movie. So I started writing it back then because I was working from home. So like I say, I work in a special school and lots of people have multiple diagnoses and everyone, you know, it was the first lockdown and I think everyone was really megally scared. So we took made the precautions and we kind of closed the school, but our support staff went to people's homes and we taught still and all of that. But it was weird working from home, you know, because I'd go to work and my day is very structured. And for the first month of working from home, I kind of fell into a bit of a slump where I didn't do much of anything.
Yeah.
You know, other than the bare minimum. And that's not like me. Normally I've got like 20 projects on the go, you know. And so I really took to kind of writing to kind of get me out of that slump. When I noticed I was watching, because it's so easy to watch, like, daytime TV is rubbish, and yet, strangely, you find yourself watching things that, you know, what the hell am I watching? You kind of come round a little bit. And so whenever those moments would happen, I'd kind of get a notebook and go outside or take my hours exercise or whatever it was, you know. And so it came to me that actually I wasn't just in a slump with my normal day-to-day routines. It was everything. It was affecting everything, even my witchcraft. And so I had to make a concerted effort. And then I guess with the writing anyway, I started writing what I thought was going to be a series of articles, I guess. And it started to come together and I thought, hang on a minute, there's something here. And originally the idea was still the same. I always intended to write something that somebody, didn't matter how experienced they were or if they were an absolute beginner, they could go to and they could pick it up and they could go to any part of it and just do something. That was always my aim. And originally it was going to kind of be a book with a spell or a working or a ritual for every day of the year. But then as I kind of started writing and it kind of progressed, it kind of looked a bit different. And I have to thank the editorial team at Llewellyn. They were so helpful. Because I think as a writer, it's easy to, so you write this big thing with lots of words and but all these ideas. And sometimes you just have to get it down onto the page. One of my editors at Gods and Radicals, actually. So I have a couple of books out with those guys as well. And so I remember, I think it was the first book I wrote them. So I sent it off and my editor got back to me and he said, this is great, but he said, it's really polished for a first draft. And imposter syndrome is a real thing. And I've always been a kind of perfectionist about when you've written something or when you've made something and it's from inside you, I don't know, it's kind of becomes a bit precious and it's easy to get lost in it. And so I had this thing and I sent it away to the lovely people at Llewellyn and they came back with lots of suggestions and tips on, you know, maybe the structure. And so it was really helpful. I had a bit of help with that because there's a lot of stuff in the book.
Absolutely. And I think, like you say, one of the great aspects of being a great writer is the fact that you've got to be able to take constructive criticism. And they're not telling you that you've done something wrong. They just, you know, that's what they do. That's what an editor's there for. It's there to say, yeah, this is really great. However, what about this or doing it that way or mix it up a bit. So I think you're quite right that often you've got that kind of battle between imposter syndrome and your ego where you've got yin and yang going on, Emma, where you're like, is this good enough? Oh, it's amazing. Is it good enough? Is it amazing? No, it's amazing. What's wrong? And therefore you've got to try and, as with anything, you've got to find a happy medium where you can take it on board knowing that what you're being told is for the betterment of both you and the piece of work that you're doing.
Absolutely, you know. And the thing is with anything that you're doing, even with magic and witchcraft, it always pays to kind of take a step back. So as an example, as a writer, you know, you write something. It can be like a short story. It can be an article that's like 1,000 words long. But when you're caught up in the act of writing it and then you go to edit it as soon as you've finished it, you miss lots of mistakes.
Yeah.
Because it's still fresh in your mind what you wanted to say, and you kind of eyes in your mind fool you to thinking that. So an example would be what I'm terrible about when I'm writing is words that, so here and here,
for example, yeah.
Hearing and hearing the place. Sometimes if I'm writing this thing here in this place, I will write here as in I heard a sound.
Mm.
You don't notice it straight away when you read back through it.
Yeah.
Because it's still fresh in your mind what you want to say, and you kind of, your mind just sees the word that you think is there.
Yeah.
So you leave it a few days, a week, and you go back, and then you pick up lots of little mistakes. Some are obvious, some are little grammatical errors. And I guess it's the same when you write a larger work as well, but to a bigger extent. And so you do need a team around you. And I think it's the same with anything, even if you practice a solitary tradition or past, you know, having a community, even if it's an online community that someone you can ask questions, you can ask them questions and kind of bounce ideas off, that's all useful and helpful, you know, and it allows us to grow.
I found that very interesting as well in the first section of the book when you're talking about the basics, and the first thing you really cover is having an alter, Emma. And once again, that's something there that's quite surprising, because when you say the word alter, people instantly have a picture of you've got a space in your room or your house where you've got a table and you've built all these things up. But that's just the Hollywood version, I suspect, of the alter, because as you say, it doesn't have to be on a table. It's a space. It can be on a shelf. It can even be in a box if you want it to be, or a case to make it a portable one, which I found, which made me chuckle that, you know, there would be people wandering around the UK with a portable altar under them.
You might be surprised, Paul.
I would not have been surprised, Emma, at all.
Yeah, but, you know, I think sometimes, again, you're right, people have an idea of what something is, and you're right, it is like a Hollywood kind of mythological idea, you know, which is great if you're rich and you live alone with no pets and no one who visits and all of that kind of stuff. But in real life, it doesn't happen. Most of us, if we don't live with people, we've got pets, or we live in, maybe our houses are small and we share our spaces and we don't have room for a full-on setup, or maybe even it might be that your path is quite closed and you are not yet open about what you do, and you just don't want people to know, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You have to be comfortable in what you're doing, and if you don't want people to know, that's absolutely fine. And so there's lots of reasons as to why someone might not have a full-on altar out all of the time. I'm quite lucky in that my children are grown up now. They're 19 and 21, and I'm pretty open with what I do, as you can imagine. So, you know, it's no surprise when people come around and I have herbs hanging under the stairs, or people don't ask anymore what's in the jar. Let's put it that way. So I'm quite lucky, like I say. But even still, I've got a crazy Patterdale Terrier who chases anything that moves. Currently, because it's been nice weather, we've had the windows open, it's flies. And it doesn't matter where the fly lands, it's buzzing over, the dog is there. It like jumps first and thinks after. And so, you know, you have to be practical in your witchcraft. And I think one of the things I wanted to get across is that, as well, is that you don't actually have to buy a lot of stuff. So I write for, one of the places I write for is Gods and Radicals, and they're pagan anti-capitalist, and lots of their principles align with my own. And one of the things that I'm quite passionate about is making people aware that actually you don't need money to practice witchcraft. And I think one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it is when I was younger and my children were very little, and, you know, before they went to school, and my partner worked and I was a stay-at-home mom, and so we only had one wage coming in, and so, you know, money was always tight. There was never anything left over, and if 1 week or 1 month there was, you know, you kind of used it as a treat for the kids or the family, because those things were rare. You know, a lot of the time I found myself being left out because of financial reasons. So there were courses that, or things that you wanted to do, or I don't know, even books. And I think the thing is that a lot of people also who aren't in that situation where they're worrying about money, or, you know, when you're looking at a book that costs even as little as £5, and you're thinking to yourself, actually, I can't buy this book because that five is my family's tea for the night, you know.
Yeah.
So one of the things I'm absolutely passionate about is making witchcraft accessible and making people aware that actually you don't need to purchase anything. That's not to say there's anything wrong with buying stuff, you know. And I always say to people that you should buy, if you're going to buy something, at least buy the best quality that you can afford. But at the same time, don't beat yourself up if you can only afford like a really basic thing, because it doesn't really matter. So I talk about maybe getting your tools from flea markets, from car boots. I love a good car boot sale.
Yeah, true.
Secondhand shops, antique centres. And when I say antiques, you know, I'm not talking about the really posh stuff. There's a massive antique centre in my town.
Mm.
And on the upper floor, there's lots of cabinets with lots of little knickknacks in. And, you know, some of them are a couple of quid, right? You know, so there's lots of ways around spending a lot of money. And the thing is as well, if you go to the flea markets and you go to secondhand shops and you find really interesting stuff that nobody else has. So that was one of the things I really wanted to get across to people with the setup of the altar and your basic tools. You don't have to spend anything at all.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think as with anything, when you're talking about any kind of aspect of folklore or the paranormal or anything, witchcraft as well, Emma, it's very easy to fall into that trap of, well, I have to spend this much for it to be a proper setup. And it's not that. It's what works for you. Like you say, there are so many constraints you have to analyse and work with that if you go chasing that kind of thing, it's going to leave you deeply dissatisfied, because once you get into that kind of cycle, it's then, well, you're always looking to upgrade and get something else. And it's and eventually, as with anything like that, it can soon run out of control. So it's nice that you've got this removal of any kind of snobbery, Emma, that it's plain and simple and this is all you need to start.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to go out and buy fancy stuff, there's nothing wrong with that either, if that's what you fancy, you know.
Mm.
But I just think witchcraft historically has always been a tool of the poor, the oppressed.
Yeah.
And actually, if you take Obeah, for example, this is something I always talk about. And if you look at the history of the Caribbean, in particular Jamaica, because that's where my father's side of the family come from. If you look at the history of Obeah and Jamaica and the Caribbean, what you see is that actually the Obeah men and women, the enslaved, had literally nothing. And I think one of the things about the Caribbean and slavery as well is it's uncomfortable to talk about, I know, but it was brutal, you know. I mean, slavery was brutal anyway, but I was listening to a talk a couple of weeks ago, and you know, one of the statistics the talker gave was amazing. She was talking about the sheer number of slaves who were actually imported to Jamaica, and by the time emancipation came, the number of slaves left, and because of the brutal conditions, they were worked to death.
Mm.
And so when we look at the history of Obeah and how it was used in the Caribbean, there are those links to the poor and the oppressed. And it's the same if we look back to last year, I went to Pendle, you know, and
yes,
you know, but the history of the accused people, actually, they were destitute people, you know. And so for me, I guess that's something that's close to my heart, is that it's always been, witchcraft is adaptable because it's always been used by those who are oppressed and misaligned and, you know, maybe didn't have anything. And so it had to be adaptable, and we can continue to adapt it today. You know, it isn't static. It's not something that's never changes. So I just feel it's so important to kind of always keep that in mind.
And for a lot of it, it's got its roots in the environment that the person who's practicing it finds themselves in, like you say. They have to utilize what's at hand. So for me, it's plainly obvious that if you are living on the edges of society and for whatever reason, Emma, then you simply have to use what's available to you. You can't sort of go out on the hunt for things when that option isn't available to you. And that's the same, as you say, when it comes to that, you know, we're talking about people who were living on the very margins of
land, yeah,
but you know, hanging on by their fingertips and living day to day and hand to mouth, essentially, for a lot of the time. So they couldn't sort of run about and find all kinds of things. They had to use the earth around them and nature and the water and the earth that they lived in to basically build whatever they needed to support them and survive with their practice.
Absolutely. And it goes back to, you know, to what we were talking about in the beginning when we were kind of talking about how I mixed the beer with the witchcraft and how that kind of happened. And actually, it happened quite naturally because they share... There's a lot of similarities, you know. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but there's a lot of similarities between, I guess you might call it folk magic, traditional British folk magic, and Obeah. In that, like you say, the people had to be adaptable. They had to use what they liked, what they had around them. So, for example, if you take Nanny of the Maroons, who is a, today she's a Jamaican national hero, but she was an enslaved Ghanaian woman brought to Jamaica and to work on the plantations, and she escaped slavery and kind of beat the British into submission using guerrilla warfare tactic. And even today, Maroon communities exist in the western mountains of Jamaica. And so when people say, well, how can you practice Obeah in England alongside English witchcraft? It's quite easy for me because actually, if we look at Nanny of the Maroons, and I often use her as an example. So she brought Obeah with her from her homeland, and there would have been differences from what she had in Ghana to what she would have had available in Jamaica, but it's that relationship with the land, getting to know the land and using what you have available to you to the maximum effect. And it's the same with witchcraft. Whatever you don't have, whatever doesn't grow near you, and I guess this is why there's so many different associations and substitutions and correspondences you can use in spell work and ritual. There's always something. It doesn't matter where you are. But just like one fact I find really interesting, you know, is that they used to be root diggers. So it was a profession, usually men, males, and they would go up and down the country and they would harvest plants from different areas. So as they traveled, they'd bring witches in one area, plants that didn't grow then from somewhere else. So I just find that really interesting, you know.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, it's one of those things, like you say, when especially when you come halfway across the world, you've got to get used to different plants, different environments, different aspects to it all. So you have to kind of be as flexible as possible if you want to continue doing what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same today in our own witchcraft. So if we want to continue practicing, we have to work around all of those constraints that we have, all of those things that throw a spanner in the works, and they're annoying, you know. They're annoying, but you just have to adapt to them. Otherwise, what's the alternative?
Absolutely. I think one of the other sections of the book I found really interesting is the Sabbats, because I think if you say to people about Sabbats, most people will know the two key ones for the general populace, which are obviously summer solstice and Yule. But as we were saying, we've just passed Beltane. And then I was very interested because I knew about six of them, but I didn't know there was eight. And I have to be brutally honest with you. I'm going to be as candid as I can be with you. So it was very interesting for me. So for anybody who's not aware of it, these eight Sabbats, what do they represent, and how do the members of the Wicca fraternity look to utilise or celebrate these particular days?
Generally, I guess what they're best described as really is markers of the British agricultural or European agricultural calendar. And I guess this is where perhaps they've kind of fallen away in relevance to some people because, you know, for example, if we start with Imhoc in February, or otherwise known as Candlemas, and there's a lot of crossover with a lot of the Christian celebration as well, the discussion that goes with that. But so you start with Imhoc, and that is kind of, I always describe it as that moment where spring is coming, but it's still winter, where you notice like the crocus and the snowdrops and the daffodils coming up. Sometimes they're coming up through the snow, you know, so it's still, especially where we live. Sometimes it's still very much winter, but, you know, it's that hope of something to come. It's that beginning awakening where you're just starting to kind of feel that rhythm. And then as the Sabbats move along, you know, our star is what we kind of related to Easter, generally speaking. eggs and fertility and spring is sprung. And then you've got Beltane, which we just had, May Day. And so what they mark really for me, and I guess for people who live where we do and in other European countries, they really, it might be more meaningful where you see those changes occur in the landscape around you. But I guess if you live somewhere where it's warm all year round, you know, maybe you, it can feel off kilter, perhaps the weather of the year. And so what I wanted to talk about when I wrote the book was actually, and again, you know, for me, it's about animism and spirit work and all of that side of it. Because there's always that crossover in what we do as witches or whatever you want to call yourself. Mm. And so for me, what's important is that actually we begin to, like we've been talking about throughout this whole kind of session, we've been talking about making things your own. And you have to do the same with the Sabbats as well if you want to kind of reclaim the wheel of the year, so to speak. You know, you have to kind of match them up to what's happening with where you live. So, for example, if we take Yule, the winter solstice, for example, and lots of our imagery in, you know, European cultures are the dark nights, colder weather, evergreen trees, all of that kind of stuff. But if you live somewhere that's more typical to a desert environment, that's not going to be the same. And so what I hope comes across is that people kind of delve into the folklore of where they live and delve into what's happening in the land where they live. And it can be as simple as going out and just paying attention and just watching, you know. I just find it's really important that we, if you want to utilize the Sabbats in a meaningful way, that you kind of make them more relatable for you. And, you know, it's exciting to do that, I think.
Yeah. And I think for me as well, it's interesting as well how certain aspects of the Sabbats have been adapted and utilized, because often as a kid growing up, Emma, I remember we always used to have harvest festivals in August in a lot of places. So it was very interesting when I was reading the breakdown of this and you were talking about the Festival of Litha, that it's about, one of the aspects of this is building a corn dolly. So that was always something I associated as a kid with late summer and the harvest festival. And it's, you know, the fields have been tilled and everybody's got all their crops in and all the fruit's been picked. And it always reminds me of a kid that people would have these competitions trying to build little corn dollies. But then when I read your book, it's obviously like 2 months before this that you look to sort of use the corn doll sort of more sort of mid fertile period for crops.
Yeah. So if you want to make the corn dolly, it's always best to use like the corn before it gets too stiff. So it's, yeah, because you don't want it to snap as you're bending it.
Yeah.
But of course you can make them throughout the whole of the harvest festival. And this is what I kind of mean, where we don't have to be so strict and it can depend on where you live. So if you take, I actually think of three of the Sabbats as three different types of harvest festival. So you've got Litha, which is quite early on. So you might have the soft fruits and berries beginning to ripen, you know, and then you've got later on where you've got maybe, you know, your apples and your pears and that kind of harvest. And then in October, Halloween or Samhain, you've got what would be traditionally called the blood harvest, where traditionally it's before the winter. So, you know, back in the day, farmers might have been looking to thin the herd, maybe cool older or weaker members of the herd, so as to kind of protect the herd and to have meat throughout the winter months. And so I actually see the harvests as being kind of three different ones, but it's important that you kind of make them your own. So for me, I like to make my corn dolly quite early on, but it doesn't really matter when you make it. Traditionally, across many parts of Britain, it was made with perhaps the last cut of the corn, or the last cut of whatever crop, you know, you might have been, whatever grain crop you might have been wearing, because it was said that the spirit of the corn, the spirit of the harvest, it was in that last remaining cut. And so you would fashion the corn dolly from that, and you know, you would look after that and house the spirit, so to speak, over winter. And then when, you know, the next year comes around in spring or at Beltane, you would go back and release the corn dolly, so the spirit of the corn back to the land, and so to get a good harvest. And so there's no right or wrong way of doing these things. And one of the things that I particularly am passionate about is making witchcraft accessible. And like I say, lots of this comes from my own experience. And there's been many times, particularly when you knew, you might not be sure of the dates of the Sabbat, but you know they're coming up, and you know you might make plans, but then you forget and the day comes round. And it's like we kind of talked about with the full moon, you know, the Sabbat comes round and you're not ready, or you're ill prepared, or something happens where you can't do what you had planned. And so you think, oh, well, damn it, maybe next time. But again, you know, you end up doing nothing that way. And so for me, each particular day is just a marker of the season. And the energy, it's not the energies just magically appear at that one day, and then after that day, they disappear. You know, the energies are still there. You can work with them throughout that whole season. I have to say that the wheel never stops turning. You know, it doesn't stop on that particular point. It's always turning incrementally. And so those energies, they ebb and flow, you know, and so you can always work with them.
Absolutely. And I think it's very interesting because, like I say, because obviously a lot of people will know the Sabbath, the key Sabbath, I think, that mm-hmm. everybody tries to enjoy. And once again, yeah. something that's come massively into favour over the last sort of 30 years is obviously Samhain. Or as Donald Pleasance famously mispronounced it, Samhain in Halloween. And caused many a practitioner of Wicca to shout at their televisions if they enjoyed horror films. Emma, I would imagine, and it always makes me laugh because it's one of my favourite films, and I always say it under my Samhain, Donald. Samhain. That's one of those that it's very interesting how certain ones, because obviously Yule, Christmas, whatever people want to celebrate it as, and Samhain are the two main ones that seem to have sort of indelibly linked themselves into popular culture these days. And it's very interesting how there seems to be a real sort of acceptance of two of the Sabbats in the general populace, and yet the other six, it depends, like we were saying, about where you're from and the area you grow up in. And obviously, I think we would be hard-pressed. I mean, I'm not sure how things are where you live now, Emma, but I can't remember the last time I saw a harvest festival advertised anywhere. And it seems a real shame that some of these traditions that, yes, people may not really consider them to be part of the Wicca calendar or witchcraft or these particular important dates. But as you say, because people had a real connection with their environment, and obviously for a lot of people, as we were saying, who lived hand to mouth, the crops were the most important part of the year. It was all about making sure you had enough food to get through the winter.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a rural town, and my dad, he was a self-styled poacher back in the day, you know, so he would hunt for meat. So when I talk, I'm a vegetarian now, but when I was a child, I did used to eat meat, and it was normal to see rabbits hanging on the porch. You know, we'd been out with the dogs and hunted them, and you hang them before you skin them, gut them, and all of that gross stuff. But that was very normal to me. And there was always a saying, like I remember, about you shouldn't hunt for rabbit in any of the months with an R in their name. You know, it's always that thing of in folklore, and this is why I love folklore, and I think it can be a really good way of connecting to the cycles of the seasons and the Sabbaths. There's always that grain of truth, and I think it has something to do with, you know, that's the time when the does are pregnant or milking, and it affects the meat. So unless you were desperate, you wouldn't hunt in those times of the year. But again, you wouldn't know that. I know that because my dad was a hunter growing up, but it's not something most people would be aware of. And so it's very easy to lose touch with the cycles of the seasons. Most of us go to the supermarket for our food. You know, everything is available to us at all times of the year, you know. So sometimes we've kind of lost touch with the cycles of the seasons and, you know, the harvest festivals, because we've kind of lost touch of how important they are. They still are as important as they've ever been, but there's that almost separation between the food on our plate and how it got there. And I think, like you say, it happens with the other Sabbaths, the ones that kind of have fallen away from popular knowledge. And I think, like you say, with the main two, so you've got Christmas and Yule, and then Halloween and Samhain. I think what part of the reason they've stayed so popular is that if we look at when they occur when, well, at least where we live, the weather's starting to turn, it's getting colder, the nights are drawing in, you know. And so I often think they perhaps stuck around because they're a way to lighten the mood.
Mm.
And particularly if we think back to even not that long ago when people might have been really poor, they might have struggled to heat their homes. It can be, if you're poor and struggling and, you know, back in the day, you think 100 years back, 200 years back when people were celebrating these. If you think about the poorest people in society, they would have had very little. There would have been almost nothing to look forward to.
Yes.
And so I think part of the reason those ones in particular have stayed so popular is that it's a way of kind of seeing off the dark. We seemed as a species to have that fear of the dark for whatever reason.
Mm.
And for me, it's a way of staving it off. So at Halloween, you know, for me, Halloween and Samhain are two different things.
Yeah.
And I love both, you know. I know some witches don't like Halloween and might see it as disrespectful, but I love both. And I think I love both for partly that reason. Halloween is the fun aspect where we confront our fears in a fun way, you know, and we laugh at ourselves and we laugh at our fears. And I guess it's kind of a way of sticking two fingers up to the dark and all of the things we're scared of, you know, that will happen in the dark winter months. And, yeah, you know, hundreds of years ago, you'd have been deaf from many different sources, would have been a very real threat, from freezing to death, being so cold, you know, not having enough food, not being able to heat your home. All of those things would have contributed to ill health. So there were lots of very real fears that our ancestors would have had for the darker months. And it's the same with Yule as well, I guess. You know, it's all lights, it's all merriment. We surround ourselves with our loved ones and we share what we have left and make the most of it. And I think there is that element of just coming together to kind of survive the darkness. And I think it's an overhand from, I could be wrong, this is just my own musings on the matter, but they make sense to me as to why those two in particular have stuck out when perhaps the others are less well known.
Yeah, you're probably right as well, because I think often many of us, that sort of running to Yule and Christmas, it seems everybody's quite positive and everybody's looking forward to it. And Samhain sort of marks the sort of countdown. You know, you're only sort of 8 or 9 weeks away from getting some nice presents and things.
Yeah, you know, lots of my friends, as soon as Halloween is done, you know, but lots of my non-witchy friends, as soon as Halloween is done, the next day their Christmas tree's up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not, I know, you know, a lot of people did that over the last couple of years to put a little bit of cheer. I have to say the first year of the lockdown, I think it was the earliest I'd ever put my Christmas tree. It was mid-November. And we just thought, what the hell? Nobody's coming around.
Yeah.
who gives a damn?
I think we were all in need of some extra cheer that year, weren't we?
Absolutely, definitely. Twinkly lights always help, Emma. Always helps.
They do indeed.
I think one of the other key aspects of British witchcraft and witchcraft in general is also the importance that the moon plays in a lot of it. And for me, I've found this really interesting to understand how the different cycles of the moon reflect in the practice and belief in witchcraft and certain aspects of it, Emma. So for anybody who's not aware of these different cycles and how these different stages of the moon work, I believe there are sort of six key points, aren't there, for the moon cycle that are sort of utilized in practicing witchcraft?
Yeah. I think for most people who don't pay any attention to the moon or little attention, obviously the crescent moon, you know, waxing and waning, and the full moon. And other than that, we don't really pay much attention. But, and again, it's similar to the seasons, where I often think these are set markers. So the energies are an ebb and flow. It's the full moon. And after it's the full moon, those energies stop and it's something else. They kind of flow into the next. So how I mark the moon, and again, not everybody does it this way. So for me, the dark moon and the new moon are two different things. Some people use the terms interchangeably, and technically they are the same thing.
Mm.
But I like to make the distinction of the dark moon because for me, that's when there is no moon visible in the sky. And again, I think a lot of it goes back to, because I'm a bit of a folklore nerd and a history nerd, and I like that kind of stuff. And for me, I often think back to our ancestors and what was visible, and they didn't have the technology we have, you know, so I can go online at any given day and find the exact phase of the moon to like the percentage of how full it is,
yes,
at any given time of day. But our ancestors wouldn't have had that. They'd have just had their eyes and what they saw. And so, and I think there's a raw kind of power in that. It's great to know the exact timings, don't get me wrong, but there's something kind of, I don't know, there's just something about looking up at the sky and seeing the moon and being able to know what phase it is by sight, or there's no moon in the sky, this is the dark moon. So for me, the dark moon is when there is no moon visible in the sky. The new moon is when you get that first tiny sliver that my partner often describes as a toenail.
I know exactly what they're describing.
So that's the new moon. And then obviously as it moves, you've got the waning. And if you want to be, you know, you can be as exact as you want to be. But for me, when you get to being that exact, I personally feel that when I'm being like that, I lose something. I can't quite put my finger on what it is, but that's just me personally. That's just my own kind of, I don't know, idiosyncrasy, I guess. But yeah.
I think as you touch on as well, clearly for cultures all across the world, the moon has always been seen as important, be it in Asia, in Africa, in the Americas. The moon has always had some kind of semblance and a mysticism to it that for many beliefs and religious groups, Emma, the moon has always been a very important aspect of their belief structures.
Yeah, you can get in, I think in the witchcraft world, you can get very caught up in dramas and controversies and this, that, and the other. And I think sometimes we lose sight of all of the things that connect us and our shared humanity. And I think the moon is one of those things that does that. Every culture has a moon spirit, a moon deity, a being associated with the moon in some way, shape, or form, you know. And so I think it's really important that we remember those shared connections. Especially in a time when issues can kind of flare up and divide people and all of that kind of stuff. I always think it's important to kind of just keep one eye on all of the important stuff too.
Absolutely. I think often we misinterpret things and forget that there are more things that connect us across the world than separate us, really.
Yeah. And, you know, the moon and magic, and moon magic is just one of those things that can do that. And I think one of the things I really wanted to get across in the book, and I hope it does so, and I think particularly with moon magic, is it doesn't matter what tradition or form of magic or witchcraft you practice, you can incorporate the moon into that as well, you know, in ways that work for you.
And I think it's also interesting, as you mention in the book, that different cycles of the moon have sort of a certain meaning, like when, as we were saying about a dark moon, it's all about the unconscious, the unseen, the unknown.
Yeah, it's a perfect time to kind of concentrate on yourself and work on yourself. And I think that can be an important part of moon magic, because I think in today's world where, you know, we get told it's selfish to be thinking of yourself all the time. And actually, I think most of us don't think of ourselves all the time. Most of us think of ourselves very little. Most of us put ourselves last above all the other people we care about, you know, which is a lovely thing to do. But at the same time, we have to have that element of self-care, because otherwise we burn out. And it's the same with whatever you do, with your work, with your witchcraft, with whatever you do, no matter how much you love it, you have to have that time to just step back, to refocus, to just chill out a little bit. And I think the dark moon is perfect for doing that. You know, it's almost like you can just chill out. There's no expectation on you. You can just retreat a little bit and kind of find yourself again.
So for someone who's sort of dipping their toe into it, Emma, is it a case of you can sort of focus on one particular cycle of the moon for your rituals, or is it one of those aspects of it that you have to appreciate and respect all the cycles?
No, again, you can do whatever works for you, you know. I mostly mark the full moon and the dark moon that, you know, that's not to say that the other moon phases aren't important. And if I am planning, say, a ritual or a working or something, I might consider the moon phases if it's practical for me to do that. But sometimes if I need to do something on the cusp, or I feel like I just want to do something, but it's not the correct moon phase, well, I'm not going to get too hung up on that.
Mm.
But generally, I regularly mark the dark moon and the full moon, because one of the things in timing, I don't have time to mark all of them, but the full moon and the dark moon, they're kind of, I guess, the two most visible times of the moon phase. You've got either the bright full moon shining down, casting its silvery glow, or you've got the dark of the dark moon. And so they're more noticeable, I guess, for me at least, anyway.
Absolutely. So it's whatever's significant for you and what appeals to you, I suspect.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've got to make it that way. And I think all of witchcraft is a compromise. Whether we think it is or not, it's a compromise within ourselves. You know, we have to decide what our practice is going to be. We have to, who wouldn't love to live a fully magical life if only we didn't have to work and take care of people and all that other stuff? It'd be great. But we all have lives to lead. You know, we've all got families or people who depend on us in some way, shape or form. You know, you might have a job, you might have something else that kind of gets in the way a little bit. Things we have to do, things we have to take care of, because that's life, you know?
Mm.
And so I think we have to be realistic with what we have the time to do. So you may want to celebrate all of the phases of the moon, but you might find that actually you're only consistently marking one or two. That's fine to have that. And this is where the trial and error and just experimenting and playing around with stuff comes in. It's about finding what works best for you. And it's fun too, you know, the process is fun. So.
Absolutely. I think the last thing I'd like to touch on before I let you return to normality, as it were, is, I know you've mentioned it earlier in regards to animism, Emma.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still surprised in this day and age that people, in my experience, it would seem to think that animism tends to sort of only be part of the Wicca belief system. Because when you look at some of the major religions around the world, Shinto, Buddhism, Hinduism, They all have a deep connection with animism. And I find it odd that often when we talk about Wicca and the practicing of witchcraft, animism sometimes seems to be a stick that the believers and the practitioners of this faith are hit with, because, you know, as sometimes, and I hate to use the term about the woo, but I find it odd that people seem to know so little about the other major religions in the world that have a deep aspect of their belief system that is based in animism.
Yeah. And I think, I think it's just that case of not knowing what animism is, or perhaps not understanding what it means. You know, for me, animism means that I think that everything in the natural world has a spirit or soul, and other people might believe that everything in the world, whether it's a man-made item or a natural item, has some sort of spirit. I guess it's kind of just part of it is just coming to terms with what that means for you. For me, like I say, things in the natural world have a spirit, have a soul, is imbued with life, because it just makes sense in my mind. Because at heart, I'm a bit of a hermeticist as well. I love hermeticism and the elements and occult philosophy and how that relates to the elements and the makeup of the world and all of that. It makes sense to me. And generally with my own experiences, that the natural world is imbued with spirit. And so I think part of it is kind of just coming to terms with what it means for you and not getting too caught up on the textbook definition or what somebody tells you it means. And a good way of kind of beginning that work, I think, is just to spend time outside. It might be a garden. It might be, you might live in a city and you just have a balcony or a window, you know, open your window and just, you let some fresh air in, look out, close your eyes, listen to the sound, you know, it doesn't matter where you are. And for me, that's a really good way of beginning that work with animism and kind of beginning to understand what it means to you. I think you could apply it to when I certainly think about it, as a my understanding of what animism is and my experience with animism, I could, absolutely apply it to everything. even things that we do and they think they don't have any religious significance or spiritual significance, even things that people do who might think of themselves as atheists, the little rituals that we all go through a lot of the time without thinking. If you have a dog and you come home, or any animal, you come home, how many of us talk to our pets?
Yep.
Or even our plants, or even you just pottering about the house and you're just speaking to yourself. I think those are all examples of animism in a way, even the talking to yourself, because those words are leaving you, they're imbued with meaning. And I think in very subtle ways, our actions affect the spirit of the place. They have an impact, even if we don't always see that impact or feel it because it's so tiny. And so you can begin to kind of, when you think of it that way, you know, I think it starts to make sense to people a little bit more.
Absolutely. And I think it's very interesting as well, because I've heard over the last sort of 5 or 10 years, Emma, that there are certain theoretical physicists who, to all degrees and purposes, are basically saying that animism is a real thing, that all objects have some kind of sentience, which I find a remarkable concept, that because of who's saying it, people listen to it. If that makes sense.
It becomes less woo when the scientists tell us, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think Michio Kaku is probably the most famous exponent of this philosophy. And I've heard him talk about this. And I remember the first time I heard him speaking about it, I was thinking, I'm sure this is not the realms of physicists that I would normally expect. But as with anything, and often when we look at the history of folklore and religious practices from certain areas of the world, it is very interesting how once it gets accepted into science, as it was, then all of a sudden it's real.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of like we need that authority to tell us it's okay to believe this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, but you're right. And I just think we see it in so many ways. And now, like, the science is kind of catching up. And even how we view science, it's just science always changes. Again, science isn't something that's static. And what I find really interesting, so I'm a keen forager. I love going foraging. And where I live, autumn is like mushroom season. So I'm always in the woods, like, looking for mushrooms in that time of year. And one of the things that I really kind of enjoy at the moment is that it's really becoming quite mainstream, mycelium and mushrooms and fungi, all of that stuff. It's really becoming more open about how the mycelium connects, you know, in a woodland, it connects the trees. I think there was some, I can't remember the exact specifics, but I think there was some research about how the trees and plants communicate through the mycelium networks underneath the ground and the forest floor. And I think it's just so exciting and interesting. I don't know, it just feels like all of those connections that a lot of us have felt or perhaps known for a while are now becoming, you know, more accepted, which I just think is a good thing.
Absolutely. I remember I did an episode nearly a couple of years ago, Emma, which was talking about some of the groundbreaking research that was going on in regards to the intelligence of plants.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it blew my mind when I dove into it fully and started reading some scientific papers that had been released over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, that what we think trees and plants, and as you say, I mean, mushrooms have been shown recently to create their own ecosystems, for God's sakes. So if you'd have said that to somebody 20 years ago, they'd have thought you were crackers. And now we know that they can alter their own temperature. They can create little winds around them.
Yeah.
There is so much that that we presume is folklore or superstitions. And yet, the more that science opens up to some of these avenues, the more obvious some of these traditions become. And you think, well, it's always been there. It's just a case of who's the messenger.
Yeah. And I really love folklore. And again, it's something that I find really interesting. And I often think learning the folklore of where you live is a good way of entering into the realms of animism.
Mm.
Because in all of the stories that we hear, the folk stories that we hear and the tales and the myths and the legends, they are often to do with nature or natural phenomenon, or, you know, there's always those grains of truth in them to some extent. And they're so fascinating to listen to, as fantastical as they often sound. And you think, oh, how could they believe this? Or, you know, but actually it's a story made to entertain, but with the truth hidden in there. And I guess as a writer and a reader, an avid reader, I think that's where all the best stories start. They start with that grain of truth.
Mm.
And I think that's what's so exciting about folklore, is you can dive into it and you can really begin to get to know a place through the lens of the people who have lived there before us. And it's, I always think, it's a great way into animism, is to look into the folklore. And, you know, you can take it any angle you want. For me, I'm a nature nerd, so I like nature folklore. But, you know, there's lots of little ways you can take it to suit your interests. And, like, yeah, it's just a good way to get into animism.
Absolutely. As with everything we've spoken about today, Emma, it's as flexible as the person that wants to learn something from it.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it.
Absolutely. Well, Emma, it's been a fascinating chance to speak with you. I wish you all the very best with the book and your continued writings. Where can everybody follow your work, read your regular articles for some of the publications that you work for, and get a copy of your book?
So you can get the book Witch Life from Llewellyn, or for the people in the UK, it's available from a lot of mainstream publishers, but also Amazon. But I share a lot of articles I write for free online, and you can find them at Gods and Radicals Press. And you can Google Gods and Radicals or abeautifulresistance.org. The House of Twigs, I write for those guys as well. But I share all the articles I write on my social medias, which is Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Emma Catherine Wild Witch, Wild Witchcraft.
Fabulous. Emma, once again, thank you so much for your time, your conversation, and your kindness talking with me tonight. And I hope I get a chance to speak to you at another point.
Same. I've had a great time. Thank you for having me on. I could talk about this stuff all night.